we do fall down, but we get up again, and that's what we must do. We inevitably find challenges and heartbreaks, but inevitably, if we want to stay on the path, we get up again.
Scott Cairns is Curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of Missouri, a librettist, essayist, translator, and author of a dozen poetry collections. He's long been a distinguished voice in American religious poetry and an influence on many of the poets we featured on this podcast. We're talking today about his latest collection, Correspondence with My Greeks, published this fall by Slant Books. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Scott Cairns, it is such a privilege to have you on this podcast. Thank you so much for your time and coming on here and talking with me.
I'm very pleased to be here with you.
Like I told you in our email correspondence, I heard you, when I first began reading more religious poetry, I heard you on a podcast. I think it was like the Image Journal. They were doing podcasts back in the day, and I think it was driving across Nebraska. And it was the best possible way to get across Nebraska was hearing your podcast with you. So I'm talking to you here is really an honor for me. So in fact, speaking of when I began turning to contemporary religious poetry a few years ago, yours was some of the first poetry that I encountered, very gratefully so. And you have a new collection of poems coming out just this fall, Correspondence with My Greeks, and it's published by Slant Books, which is publishing all kinds of great books these days. So this is a collection of poems. Let me begin by asking then about the title. So, Correspondence with My Greeks. Two questions here. First, who are your Greeks? Okay, and secondly, why do you call this collection a correspondence?
Yeah, so my Greeks are many. I almost said they are legion, but I didn't want to put any shade on them. But they, so I guess I started reading probably Kavafi back when I was at University of Utah, which seems like 1,000 years ago, but it was in the 80s. And then I dug into Sepharis and Elitis, and these poets have been on my desk, on my writing desk, nonstop since then. So, and then over the years, I've made a lot of trips to Greece. I guess in the past 20 years, I've been to Greece probably almost 30 times. So it's, you know, I spend a lot of time in Greece and learning Greek and reading and meeting live Greek poets, and then, you know, digging into their traditions because there's such a rich poetic tradition. So as for the correspondence business, I learned long ago that my own writing very often derived from my having poured over a poem or some other text, many times a patristic theology text. And generally speaking, my poems were the result of a response. So I, you know, over the years, I've incorporated that notion even into my pedagogy so that when I teach writing, I teach it hoping that my students will apprehend the fact of the matter, which is all of literature ever is one long conversation. and the more you know about how the conversation has gone prior to your arrival into it, the better your part, your contribution might prove to be. And so that over the years, you know, we talk about it in terms of dialogic, we talk about it in terms of, you know, educing from us something that's already in us. And, you know, of late, I've thought about it almost as correspondence, my writing back to the poet or to the patristic author, the saint whose text I'm pouring over. I think of it either as using that text as a springboard into new ideation, or my poem as, in some sense, the beginnings of a response, a letter back, an epistolary response to what I've seen before me.
Okay. That you remark in the collection's introduction, right, that nearly every literary work responds to the literary work. Like you just
that's how here. I see it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And that you say in there, and I'm going to quote you here, that this realization has shaped your disposition to virtually everything that you encounter. And then you add this, you say it inspires in you a willingness to attend. And I find this observation compelling, right? Because poetry is famously, it's a medium of heightened attention. So I suppose I'm wondering whether poetry for you has become maybe less a medium of writing only than a way of living, a way of learning how to attend.
Absolutely. And thank you for Matthew for noticing that. The work, the primary work now occurs to me to be the construction of a better self. The poems become an assistance to that construction. And so when I look at anything, a text, a landscape, the face of another, inevitably I'm reading. You know, I'm reading and internally coming to terms with some sort of sense of that, some way to articulate what I'm reading. And then, you know, sometimes it turns into a poem, but most often it just turns into a better relationship with what I'm seeing, or who I'm seeing. And so, yeah, I think attention is everything. The fathers speak of, nepsis is a great Greek word. It's watchfulness, you know, sort of being attentive and watching not just what's on around you, but what's inside you, and benefiting from that watchfulness to not be so distracted, not be so easily taken off the path toward the construction of a better self.
What you write in your poem in this collection titled They Open Us, and you comment there, I'm quoting here some lines, you comment on poetry's vertiginous capacity to center one's attention on what might make us whole and what might break us, spanning the desolate hours as well as the blessed. I love those lines. I was prompted to ask this question of you about poetry as a tool for living by something you write in your memoir. This is a memoir titled Short Trip to the Edge, about your first excursions, really your pilgrimages to Greece, especially kind of Mount Athos. And you write, I'm quoting you here, and this is in the memoir, I'm quoting you, you say, my sense of actual poetry writing is that before it can so much as begin, it must be recognized as a way by which we concurrently construct and discern experience. It's not a means by which we transmit ideas or narrative events we think we already understand, but a way we might discover more sustaining versions of them. It's said really well. Now, that book was first published in 2006, right? And then republished in 2016, I think, as I have the dates right.
Yeah, I think right.
Yeah, was that observation about poetry in the first edition in 2006, or was that added in the 2016 edition?
The text itself didn't change much in the subsequent. I took out some of the names of the fathers because it occurred to me at that time that there were a couple who were fairly public and accessible, but there were others whose kindness to me they preferred keep quiet. They didn't want everyone coming up knocking on their cell door and asking for.
Sure, fair enough. Yeah, Scott Cairns sent me, right, yeah.
I changed the names of most, if not all of the monks. And then the other thing that was added, I believe, were some photographs that I had taken.
Yeah, okay, all right. But that sentiment remains the same. So back to these lines in the poem, They Open Us, about poetry's vertiginous capacity to center one's attention on what might make us whole and what might break us, spending the desolate hours as well as the blessed. I'm wondering whether your thoughts on the wholeness and brokenness which poetry opens us are similar now to when you wrote those lines in your memoir 20 years ago, or whether 20 years later you've got to have a different perspective onto that.
On that particularly, I think I've just got a deeper sense of its truth. A lot of things change. And a lot of it's changed in my thinking and in my sense of self and sense of the surround. But in terms of the brokenness and the making whole, I don't see those as separate things. I actually, even then, and I think now, perceive our moments of feeling of being broken are maybe necessary prior experiences to our healing. So, I think this is the Christian life, in short, and probably any religious life taken seriously is, this sort of cycle of, I think I'm making some ground, and no, I guess I'm not making as much ground as I should be. And then that kind of momentary desolation, I've been wasting my time is inevitably replaced with a glimpse of, well, if this is me, how do I respond to this me? Yeah. Well, you work again. You get up. I love how the monks on Mount Athos, it's kind of a commonplace to observe, this old story of a pilgrim coming there and saying, "What is it you guys do here?" And the monk responds, "Well, we fall down and we get up again." And I think that's a healthy, albeit glib paraphrase of what we're talking about now is, we do fall down, but we get up again, and that's what we must do. We inevitably find challenges and heartbreaks, but inevitably, if we want to stay on the path, we get up again. And so, yeah, a lot has changed in the span of those years, but not that. In fact, I think I'm more firmly buy into that now.
Okay, so on that very subject, I'm glad you said that way. Both because it rings true. There's also a poem in your new collection, right? Correspondence with My Greeks, kind of speaks to this. At least does to me. This is how I hear it somewhat. This is the poem No Saint. It's on page 26. I'm wondering. Yeah. If you would read this for us, and here's where I'm going to go with this. You write in the poem about kind of a third-person experience, and I'm wondering about the nature of your response there to your Greek correspondence. All these poems are written kind of after or to somebody. I'm wondering if you could then read the poem for us and tell us to whom or to what you're responding in it.
Happy to do so. So my poem is called No Saint, and it's after Miltos Sapturis. He was no saint, but yes, he had found the prospect attractive. The path ahead had, by then, become less welcoming than had certain, well, most paths that had led him lately here. He turned, therefore, to witness one more time the way that he had come and saw how impossible any return would prove. This is why he stepped off the roadway altogether and made his way slowly down the time-thick slope, hoping to achieve the shore and thereafter to plunge into the sea. The poem that I'm working off of was written, as I say, by Miltos Sapturis and translated by a friend of mine named David Connolly, who, when I knew him, lived in Athens, I believe. I believe he's moved on, but the poem of Sapturis is the saint, and it's very short, so maybe I'll just move through it quickly for you.
Sure.
You'll see that I get the third person disposition also from this poem. His is called The Saint. He stared deep, deep into the well. Its depth had no end in this life. The flesh peeled off and fell bit by bit. Soon nothing would remain but his skeleton. "I've decided," he said, "I finally decided. I'll live among the drowned, among the lepers." And so, because I can't quite get there, though I admire such the saint. Mine was no saint.
Yeah.
This is as near as I can come, is to step off the path, which I thought was taking me somewhere I thought I wanted to go, and then abandoning that in favor of a descent along, you know, the time. I don't know if you've been to Greece much, but there are plenty of islands covered with time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no,
thick with time, and then you scratch your way down through the shrubbery and make it to the sea and jump in. And so I think of it as a descent into another refreshment. You know,
yeah.
Descent nonetheless is something of a recovery. So that's how that poem came to be, and that's a good sort of example of what I did. Was I read various poems by various poets. There aren't 100 in this book that I respond to, but I've probably read 100 modern Greek poets, and I found my own work enhanced by that disposition of responding to them. They of course come from a tradition that is no less responsive to what preceded it. In fact, I love how a Greek poet will work over an ancient Greek myth in a way. I mean, when you or I do it, it seems a little appropriative
yeah.
of someone else's culture. But when a Greek does it, it's like it's his own stuff. It's his own inheritance. If you know, it's actually all of our inheritance, but I think it's particularly beautiful to watch what they do with those, and what they do through successions of generations of poets. I mean, each in his or her turn works over that matter. You know, I mean, it's like one long story.
Yeah, that's right.
These are utterances that are offered into that conversation. That's how that came.
Okay, what I like about that poem you just read, and then you read the original poem that kind of which you're responding. I love that tension of saint, no saint, and one thing I really appreciate about these poems, because they're very so many of the poems in this collection, like in a lot of your collections, they're very attuned to the tenor of religious and spiritual life. And they're elegant poems, just as poems, they're elegant poems, but they're also very attuned to it, but not just in ways that express praise, but that also express the experience of struggle along a path, right? You know, up one path, leading one path for another, going back down through thickets. It's not even easy to get back down the path, but in finding refreshment amid disappointment. I find the candor and the insight in these poems to be hopeful, actually, and healing as I read them. Do you find them that way? Do you find that they're candid? You know, when you say, okay, this guy is writing about a saint, I'm going to write no saint. Do you find that there's something actually refreshing in the candor of that kind of gesture?
My answer isn't going to be satisfying, but my answer is this. My own life, my own spiritual life, is one of looking at the lives of the saints and knowing that I'm no saint, and looking at people who have acquired what we call in the Greek church theosis, you know, this
yeah.
sort of divination of the human person, which is what we're called into, and reading the works by people who are well on their way in that, and knowing that I'm not well on my way to that, but in a way, that's really what I want. You know, I too want to be holy, and so the work becomes part of that journey towards something that I deeply, deeply hunger for. But again, the cycle of desolation and wholeness is
right.
Is continuing in this life, I presume, will continue. In this model established, but in our church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Orthodox Church generally, this thing of theosis, becoming like God, doesn't actually even end at death, but from glory into glory, I don't know if you know, C.S. Lewis is the last battle from that Chronicles of Narnia bunch of books for kids, children. But you know, he has an image like that farther up and further in. Even after they're in paradise, they're going farther up and further in, attaining a kind of previously unaccomplished substantiality. Their own persons, their bodies, everything about them, their senses become more substantive.
Yeah. That's an idea I love, actually. That's an idea that my own tradition shares with yours, actually, this idea that the path continues through this life and on into the next one. And it's actually something that I so appreciate about your poems, is that they give expression both to the, I'll use your words here, the hunger, right, for a thing that one recognizes one does not yet have, right? The hunger because one's not yet arrived, so one feels a desire for the thing which is still in the distance for one. And recognizing, I want this. Oh, I'm not there. I'm nowhere near. To me, I find that frankness and that recognition to be reassuring. that it's okay not to have arrived. But it's okay also to want to get closer. I love that about the poems.
One must get up again.
Get up again. Yeah, right. And often in religious poetry, I find there's not quite as much attention given to that process getting back up. That's what I love about what you do. About the poem Love's Fool. This is on page 52.
Oh, sure.
It's an unrhymed sonnet, at least I think it is. It's 14 lines of an octet and a sestet, so I think it's an unrhymed sonnet. And it begins with a provocative redirection of the reader's thinking. But just for an experiment, maybe I could read this one and then you could comment on it and you could correct my reading.
Okay. Read.
All right, here we go. Love's Fool, and this is after, you got to sort of tell me the name of the Greek after whom this is written, because I can't pronounce that.
The Greek letters are difficult, but Manolis is his first name and Praktikakis is his last name.
I have the letters, but the pronunciation is lost in me. So here we go. But you wrote, I can pronounce yours here. So
you got to spend a lot of time with the Greeks to figure out how they actually say these things.
Yeah, well, once I've been to Mad Athos 30 times, we'll talk again, Scott. Yeah, so.
And by the way, Erasmus and pronunciation won't help you in the least. That's sort of what they teach in seminaries is it's not helpful.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, here we are. Love's Fool. No, the way you see it is not quite the way to see it. Yes, the fool glows. Love's Fool sits positively luminous there, dwarfed by his sad throne woves of flax and varicolored weeds. Look, naive, grinning, affectionate, and largely without fear. His dim wits are his greatest defense against the cruelties that would assault him, those same cruelties that assault us all, in turn, at every turn. And yes, on occasion, his dim wits prove insufficient against sudden sadness and despair, but he has only to remember the oblivious object of his love, and has only to remember the rare moment when the object of his love turned to him, smiled, raised one perfect hand to his glistening cheek. Okay,
yeah.
I love that, because the poem, there's a comical image of a dim-witted creature, okay, but the conclusion of the poem, that one perfect hand raised to the fool's cheek, conjures for me, at least, a touch of the grace of God. It's an expression of tenderness and love despite our human foolishness. Am I reading that correctly? And if I am, this poem captures, I believe, why so many people will stay on their rigorous religious paths despite their own personal shortcomings, and that's their sense of the love of God, which draws them on. Am I reading that correctly, or am I completely off base?
Yeah, I'd say one thing that might supplement what you're thinking and maybe enhance further, you know, further reading if you were to take up the poem again, which I hope you will.
I will.
The tradition of the fool. I don't know if that's something that comes on your radar much.
The holy fool. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the fool isn't. I mean, the fool is foolish. Absolutely. But the fool is not foolish for nothing. The foolish is foolish in order to help other people attend better to the ways things are. And so there's this tradition of the people who have sacrificed their own self-esteem, or even not self-esteem, they've sacrificed their esteem amongst others in order to assist others and in some way heal themselves, but also to assist others in their healing. And that's what the fool does. You know, they put on Christ to such an extent that they are, you know, deplored, but then also revered. You know, for people who have eyes to see and ears to hear, they're recognized as, they are recognized as persons whose lives are efficacious to each of our enhanced awareness of things as they are. So anyway, that's an aspect of the fool, love's fool, that we want to also bear in mind. But I too think that it results in, you know, incommensurate grace. I dare say all of our lives will result in some touch like that.
It's a beautiful image, you know, and I feel some version of that. I mean, it's so beautifully put here the way you say it, but I think any kind of sense that I've had of encounter with God, even at the remove at which I experience it, you know, the mortal distance between me and God, any sense it has always had about it some sense of this feeling of love that I can't understand because I don't feel it for myself. Right? This one, again, this beautiful, but this one perfect hand, right, raised to a glistening cheek. It's a beautiful image that captures this sense of an encounter, not just with perfection, but of tenderness and affection. I love it.
And the cheek is glistening, so one takes something from that as well.
Absolutely.
You know, this could be a moment of a penitential moment. It could be a moment of desolation. It could be any condition that would yield our weeping is probably part of what could be part of the meaning there. But then the perfect hand that nonetheless comforts.
Yes. You know what I loved about this collection? I mean, well, many things about the collection. One thing I loved, you know, that there's a great precision of language in the poems. There's a precision of of line breaks, you know, that kind of where things end and how they sometimes in jam, but they kind of continue on the sentences, but with a nuance as a function of the line break. There's also kind of in some ways, an elegance to the combination of poems in the ordering. Inside the volume. And I'm thinking of a couple, for example, just two examples of many, many, but the two poems, My Question and Orthodoxy, on pages 35 and 36. The first poem, My Question, expresses real frustration, right, at the negativity of which we live, especially of our politics, right? We seem to know what we're against. We're opposed to each other in tribal warfare, but we understand that more than we understand what we're actually for. Let me read just a smidge of this poem here, and then have you read the next poem in its entirety, if we could do that. This one here, My Question, I mean, it begins, you know, you say, yes, I've been meaning to ask, are you for or against? And then you kind of go up, carry this thought through in the end, you say, and this is good, Satan, as you know, is keen to being eternally against. This is his dark signature inscribed upon the foreheads of all who are similarly disposed. Think, carefully, the weary earth awaits. All right, okay. Yeah, think carefully in that line. And then it leads to this poem, Orthodoxy, which also evokes a sense of the wretchedness of our present age, but it strikes a different note. I wonder if you would read for us that poem, Orthodoxy. It's a lovely poem. These all are, but this I love this poem, Orthodoxy.
And this is after Nikos Kourouzos. Yes, sweet and very sweet the darkness of the nave, and also very sweet the observant surround these icons of our ancient fathers and our mothers, whose images have acquired a warm chiaroscuro from centuries of fragrant smoke, incense, beeswax wafting for centuries, attended by seamless petition and praise. Such prayers as these yet fill the air with yet another palpable sweetness. So often the world appears wretched, choked by a broken, angry, and willfully cruel people. So often the world proves wretched indeed, and its darkness is bitter. How then, to mitigate the assault waiting just beyond the narthex? How to carry at least some distance into the world this fragrance, this sweetness, these images?
That's such a beautiful poem. I love it. And I love the kind of the echo at the end of where you begin. I mean, the first couple of lines, yes, sweet and very sweet the darkness of the nave, and also very sweet the observant surround. Then at the end, come back to that notion of sweetness, how to carry at least some distance into the world this fragrance, this sweetness, these images. Can you tell us about that poem? It's lovely.
I don't often set out to write about from my own experience solely, but in this case, my own experience really informs my response to the prior poet. And I suppose I could talk a little bit about Mount Athos in general. What I love about Mount Athos is entering into the church, entering into the chapel, which is filled with prayer, filled with a sense of centuries of prayer having occurred here. And yes, the icons are a little sooty because of the oil lamps, the beeswax tapers burning for centuries in this space. And I found such peace there, such really deep peace and nearness to God in those spaces. And then, one leaves, one goes out again into the world. And even on Mount Athos, you leave a space like that, and then you make your way down to the port to get on a boat where everyone's shoving, everyone's clamoring to get to the ticket booth and then onto the boat. It's just all this hassle. It's very simple to forget and to leave the beauty and the peace of that of those moments behind, and have them dashed when you get on the boat with a bunch of yahoos who ostensibly had the same experience just moments ago, but are all too willing to let it go. And I've just have never wanted to let it go. So I guess that my question has always been, how does one's, and even in my own prayer chapel here in the house, there's a sweetness there, there's a calm there, there's a peace there, and then go out into the world, and how do you maintain that sense of God's nearness, which is is never diminished. What's diminished is our capacity, our awareness of God's nearness. So the challenge has always been for me for many years to maintain those beautiful tastes of sweetness in the darkness of the nave and bringing it into my life in the commerce of the world. So yeah, that's been the tension for me for probably my whole life.
Yeah.
Most profoundly since having gone to Mount Athos and hung out with monks.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the ways to do that, to bring that sweetness out, is to write a poem about it, which is precisely right. You know.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, that's it's very good that you say that, because I can guarantee you that the writing of the thing was an attempt to try to recover it and then bring it into view, not just for others, but to bring it back to my mind and to my heart, what that was, and then try to again to hold on to it.
Yeah.
And move on with it, not, you know, away from it. So,
and I find it lovely. It's a lovely poem and image, and many of the poems in this kind of carry with them a kind of a sweetness of this kind of experience, you know, amid the, you know, the travails and the clamor, as you put it, right, of everyday experience and just life in general. So many poems I'd love to discuss if we had the time. Is there a poem or two in the collection of which you are especially fond for whatever reason that may be?
Yeah, I like them all quite a bit, but I won't read you the whole book. But I do have, there's a life poet named Eleni Sukalianos, teaches at Brown. She's a lovely poet. This is actually her great grandfather's Angelos Sigelianos. And the poem I wrote in response to one of his poems, actually, I think this isn't a particular poem, but having read several, you know, in his, having read in his body of work, I noticed something about that to which I wanted to respond. And this is called An Explanation. Because I have been led deeply to praise, deeply to trust the firm earth bearing me, the earth stretching far as I can see from this outpost, because I never thought to defame it with dreams of transcendence, dreams of escape, nor to covet ubiquitous heresies of pure spirit. The earth's vivid spring yet freshens within the hushed noetic covert near the heart. And as I have never once so much as thought to question its goodness, but plunged my hand into that still fathomless pool and brought my cupped hand often to my lips, I have not forsaken it for any notion that might have wounded me. All this because I never felt nor thought to say, here life begins, here concludes. Chose instead to sing, the winter torrent greens the spring. The earthquake serves to settle ancient faults. And sang, holy, 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 throbs the hidden unceasing pulse that hums at the root of all things known, all things unimagined. And I had one other here. This is They Open Us, because I think you mentioned They Open Us. And this is after Nikos Pappas. Because of this poetry, which, like the gospel, opens us to waves of unexpected dangers and elations, which bids the condemned man to loose his tie as he ambles to the wall to be shot, and woos meandering millions yet to notice the brother or sister teetering on the cliff, compelling that we reach out a hand, deliver those wretched beloved ones to safety, at least to momentary safety, and in that moment, a passing sense that they are not alone. Because of poetry's vertiginous capacity to center one's attention on what might make us whole and what might break us, spanning the desolate hours as well as the blessed, and laving with honey both corpses and the morning toast, even as it raps upon the door, unrelenting in its claims. Because of this poetry rising from the souls of the ancients of every land, the generations thereafter, all the radiant host, both famous and obscure, offering their breath to the flowing chorus circling the spheres, giving voice to every exultation, every desolation ever, we raise our heads and do not shirk, obliged to sing.
I love both those poems. They're great.
Thanks. Yeah, I love those poets. they see, it's not like this matter was not my matter, but it was, you know, in my exposure to these other texts, educed, I think, from me, a cognizance that had eluded me, and then helped me articulate, come to terms, literally, to terms with that sort of hidden desire, hidden joy, hidden glimpse of reality.
Yeah, and the embrace of reality, material reality. I mean, in that first poem you read, An Explanation, I'm just looking at over it here, you know, just where it begins, because I have been led deeply to praise, deeply to trust the firm earth bearing me. And goes on, I've never thought to defame it with dreams of transcendence, dreams of escape, nor to covet ubiquitous heresies of pure spirit. So Scott Cairns, no Gnostic, right? So, you know, and I love at the end that line about even praising the earthquakes, right? The earthquake serves to settle ancient faults. You know, it's a great line. It's a beautiful idea about kind of embracing life as it's given to us in its fullness, including its rugged materiality, right? That spirit doesn't just simply ascend and fly upward.
Yeah, we call that a heresy, all right.
That's right.
So yeah, I suspect that you, like myself, I'm more likely to choose, in lieu of the notions of transcendence, a notion of immanence.
Yes.
So that the directionality is reversed, that, you know, the God comes to be in us, with us, for us, rather than skirting the matter at hand in order to attain some sort of vacuous spirituality or, you know, airy space. But no, the stuff is what Christ took on himself.
That's right.
And in so doing, infused all of us with this capacity.
Which is exactly, that's what moves me about those poems and about religious experience generally. And I love that inside your work, including in the ways that it captures, you kind of like the viscerality of our feelings, including those of regrets for things. You know, I was walking the dog this week earlier with my wife, talking about one of your poems where you talk about that feeling of chagrin that tinctures so much of your life. I was telling her, I share that. You know, I'm at the age now where I look back and I think, if, you know, so much of my life would have been better if I were better in the middle of it. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I appreciate the way that you give expression to kind of hope and religious experience, you know, feelings of closeness to God, even amidst our mortal coil. I love that. So, that you mentioned Christ coming with it. I wonder if we could sort of conclude. There's a poem, I'm gonna go back here, to the collection, Anaphora. There's a poem called, do you pronounce it Recreation or Recreation?
Whoever wants to say it can say it, but I think of it as Recreation.
Okay, that's how I read it. It's a short poem, it's a lovely poem. It's on page 63 of Anaphora. Would you read this for us?
And I will.
As a way to kind of conclude our discussion.
And when we had invented death, had severed every soul from life, we made of these our bodies sepulchres. And as we wandered dying, dim among the dying multitudes, he acquiesced to be interred in us. So when he had descended thus into our persons and the grave, he broke the limits, opening the grip. He shaped of every sepulchre a womb.
That's a great poem. You know, it's a short poem, but so beautiful. And the collection, what appears again, is titled Anaphora. Anaphora, for listeners who've forgotten, it's a style of repetition, right? One finds repetitions and variations in this poem, right? At the start of each of its three brief stanzas, right? And when we had invented death, and this is the beginning of the first, then and as we wandered dying, and then so when he had descended thus, kind of a again the echo of the structure there of the language. And it's a statement of faith, the poem is, but it's a great poetic touch at the end, right? That shaping of every sepulchre a womb. It's great.
Yeah. I wish I could claim having come up with it on my own, but like most of my thinking these days is deeply infused with patristic thought. So many of the patristic fathers and mothers have written, patristic mothers, that's an odd thing to say, but it's so. So much of their writing is really looking at the typologies that exist in scriptures. You know, that even the whale that swallows Jonah is a sepulchre, but also the youths in the fiery furnace, a sepulchre and a womb. Giving birth, Christ's descent into the sepulchre and then stepping out of it again and showing us how that rebirth from our own sepulchres might become a womb for our continuing life. So these are old notions. I mean, even Christ being interred in the mother, Mary's womb is figured in some of those texts as, you know, his being interred in a earthly burial.
That's right. Yeah.
in our flesh.
That's
and
right.
Then bringing that to life anew. So it's an old worked terrain that I just appropriated for this poem.
Yeah, to which you give new life yourself, right? It's a deeply Christian motif. And as you point out at the beginning of our conversation, these poems that you work on, all literature, all poetry is one large conversation. So here the conversation with you and patristic fathers, and there's a long-standing kind of like really classic image from Christian theology. Thank you so much, Scott, for this conversation, for the beauty and creativity and the depth of your work. You know, you've been such an influential poet, such an important poet to so many people, and thank you so much for the time talking with me today.
Matthew, I'm so pleased and so grateful for your time and your attention. I wish you all good things.
You too. Thank you.
All right. See ya.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.